Stop the podcast.
Stop the podcast.
Hi, everybody. Just to let you know, this episode of Fish is sponsored by TV licensing.
Yes, TV licensing. What are you watching on TV, Andy?
I have been watching a show that's called 2 Weeks in August.
Okay.
Despite it being July at the time of recording.
Oh, you don't have to watch TV shows in the time that their name references.
No, absolutely. I watched The Darling Buds of May in winter. Anyway, 2 Weeks in August. It's a really good series. It's set on a lovely Mediterranean holiday.
Ooh.
And it's a group of old mates from uni who've gathered together. Some of them have got kids. Some of them haven't. Some of them have been going through big life events. And it's one of those amazing pressure cooker series where things just get more and more and more tense.
Oh, those stressful ones.
I love it. I love it.
I love my comedy, I gotta say. So I've been watching Android, which is Diane Morgan's new thing, and I absolutely love it. But I just, for me, I always, on television, watch everything with someone from Bolton in it. That's basically all I watch.
And she's from Bolton.
She's from Bolton.
But in this show, I believe she's a robot.
She's a robot, and it is not certain where in the country she's from.
It depends where the facility is that makes her, I suppose.
I guess so. But what are we actually here to say?
Oh, we're here to say that if you want to watch any of these shows, your TV license covers you to watch over 400 TV channels and everything on BBC iPlayer.
That is incredible.
So 2 Weeks in August has finished going out now, but you can get hold of it on the iPlayer.
If you want to find out more about this, then go to tvl.co.uk/pod.
Now back to the tension and the stress and the misery of this episode of Fish.
Oh, I thought you were referencing Bolton. On with the podcast.
Hello, we are transmitting to you from our present, which we can only assume is your distant past, the turbulent time that was the early 21st century. Fearing the great cataclysm that will surely befall our civilization, we began this monumental reference of strange and obscure human knowledge. These recordings represent our attempt to compile and preserve wonders and esoterica that would otherwise be lost. Whether you're listening from an advanced civilization or have just reinvented the technology to decrypt our transmissions, this is our legacy to you. This is our time capsule. This is the Omnibus.
You have accessed entry 205.DA0201, certificate number 31308, Champagne in New Mexico.
I don't believe I've ever had French champagne before.
Oh, actually, all champagne is French. It's named after the region. Otherwise, it's sparkling white wine.
Katie, welcome to the show.
Thank you, John. Very glad to be here.
Why don't you tell us a little bit about yourself?
Well, I live in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, like apparently many, many other futurelings, although I don't know them, so maybe I will after this.
I think there's going to be a Pittsburgh meetup somewhere in your future where all the futurelings that live in the Pittsburgh area get together.
That'd be great.
At some comedy festival.
We should do it. That would be awesome. So I live in Pittsburgh, and I am fortunate to have a job doing consulting that takes up only some of my time. Mm-hmm. So the rest of the time I do other things for fun that I care about. I'm very involved in the local comedy scene in Pittsburgh. And outside of that, I'm very into wine and have been for a long time. Many, many years ago, a good friend of mine opened an incredible wine shop in, of all places, Wheeling, West Virginia.
Wow.
It's the best.
Really?
Yeah. Yeah.
It's got to be one of only 5 things in Wheeling, West Virginia.
Yes.
Oh, wow. So for people who aren't watching this on YouTube, they couldn't see the moment of hesitation, the precipitous, like, what am I supposed to say about this? And yet total agreement.
Well, I lived in Wheeling for several years in my 20s and had a wonderful time there. But Good Mansion Wines is the best thing in the city, in my very biased opinion. It's really cool. He bought an old mansion that was a industrialist's house and put At the time I was broke and renting a room upstairs, and he put a wine shop in the first floor, and in exchange for paying almost no rent, he started teaching my roommates and I about wine, and we worked at the shop, and it really caught for me. So that was the beginning of my wine education, which was 20 years ago. So for 20 years, I've been studying wine and just for fun, traveling and sometimes teaching other people about wine. I've taken several classes and I sometimes lead wine tastings and things like that.
Wow.
Yeah. So wine is a very fun, it's a hobby of mine, I guess. And for now, who knows, maybe someday it will become more serious, but at the moment it's a hobby. And sparkling wines especially are a favorite of mine.
As a Pittsburghian,
yes.
Do you identify culturally more up and down the Appalachian industrial corridor with Wheeling, or do you identify more east-west with either the Rust Belt, Ohio, or Philadelphia?
Yes. So the thing about Wheeling is it is part of the Rust Belt, Ohio. So Wheeling is in the northern panhandle of West Virginia, which we have a hand gesture for that, John, and it's not very polite.
I see it. It is
Wheeling's up here.
It's the middle finger of West Virginia.
Yeah, so Pennsylvania's here and Ohio's here, and Wheeling's in the middle. So although certainly it is Appalachian as well, Wheeling is, I would say, very much like at the outer edge of the Pittsburgh metro area, kind of.
Oh, it's part of the region.
Yeah, because it's on the Ohio River. The Ohio River that starts here at the point in Pittsburgh makes its way over the top of the panhandle of West Virginia and then is the border between West Virginia and Ohio. So it's steel mills all the way down and very similar. And in fact, Wheeling, I'm going to get this stuff wrong and people in Wheeling are going to be frustrated because I should know this, but there was definitely a time where Wheeling had like the most millionaires per capita. There were 11 industries that had major headquarters and companies in the Ohio Valley there in Wheeling in the late 1800s, early 1900s. So that's how the house where the wine shop is was built from a department store owner there. But it was just huge. So even though it was, you know, at the time, it's only 60 miles from Pittsburgh. It's an easy drive.
Oh, so you're part of an area that I think of a lot of Americans would think of as, well, a lot of Americans my age would think of that as an area that at least until recent memory was in decline and now is perhaps experiencing a resurgence or a revitalization.
Yeah.
And you're talking about wine culture, like fancy pants, snooty people with pink glasses and who are living in old Victorian mansions and drinking fine wine in an area that the rest of us would associate with the Pabst Blue Ribbon or...
Yes.
Or,
which, I mean, first of all, I have to say, since you mentioned this, that my grandfather was a beer distributor in Greensburg, Pennsylvania, and owned the franchise for Westmoreland County for Pabst Blue Ribbon. So my family, like, we always have Pabst. And I always say that, like, any fortune I have is built on Pabst Blue Ribbon. So,
oh wow, that's right. Yeah.
I went to college because of Pabst Blue Ribbon, and when I was growing up, my sister and I, our pajamas were exclusively Pabst Blue Ribbon T-shirts. Like, we did not know that was a strange thing. I don't think I knew it was really a beer brand because they weren't like advertised on TV. It was just what everything in our house was. All of our beach towels, all of our winter hats, everything is Pabst. So. There's no disconnect for me between being a sophisticated worldly woman and enjoying a Pabst Blue Ribbon, but I contain multitudes, I guess.
Miller High Life is the champagne
of beers. Yes, it is.
Is Pabst the sparkling wine of beers?
Pabst is at best the sparkling wine of beers. Yes. Well done. Yeah. I'm sure there have been lawsuits against Miller High Life for that slogan.
Because the French are like, that is not a champagne.
You can't use that word. But I guess maybe because it's just a slogan and not a product name, it's okay. I don't know.
Right.
That's funny. I haven't thought about
that. Well, people that drink Miller are probably not too worried about it.
No, probably not. I like a high life too, but yeah, Pabst is my family legacy for sure. But anyway, you were asking about the hoity-toityness of wine, which I think is unfortunate that that's the reputation of wine.
Are you a wine evangelist who wants everybody to drink six-buck chuck or whatever?
No, but I do think people should only drink what they like. I don't think it makes sense to spend a lot of money on something you don't enjoy just because someone else put a high value on it. But I also think you can get really good value wine for not a lot of money if you know what to look for. So that's a lot of when I like teach people about wine. It's about helping them figure out what they like at a $15 to $20 a bottle price point. And then if you find what you like there, by all means, spend more on that kind of wine and get something fantastic. But it doesn't make sense to spend $100 on a Cabernet if you don't like Cabernet. So anyway,
and are you someone who has developed their nose and palate so that you can detect notes of leather and cinnamon and gunpowder in different wines?
Yes. I mean, there was a time in my life where I was doing that more often and more faithfully. I think my palate has probably, I probably lost a little bit of my palate, but yes, I do that kind of thing.
Uh-huh. And let me ask, is there, I know that wine growing is very much a, like a component of altitude and atmosphere and soil.
Yes.
And some places like Austria and Oregon are made for wine, and Southern Washington, one of the big producers of wine.
Yes.
And other places like, say, the Amazon rainforest and so forth and so on are not suited for wine. Like, for instance, maybe Saudi Arabia isn't really the great wine producing.
For a lot of reasons, they're not growing grapes there for wine.
Oh, that's right. There would be several reasons. But are you living in a world where wine is producible? Is there a Pittsburgh wine like region? Because it's hilly, but it's not alpine.
Correct. It has a lot to do, like hills help. It has a lot to do with things called diurnal climates, which is like Oregon has that where, you know, it gets cold at night, but warms up a bit in the day. And when it can do that, if the soil has enough minerals like slate and like things that are, I think of as more rocky minerals that will hold heat. So they'll like keep the grapes from getting too cold at night, even if it's chilly because the earth holds some heat. It's very, I mean, there's a lot of complexities.
So the roots want warmth and the fruit wants crisp air.
Yeah. I mean, I don't, okay. We're out of my depth, John. I am not a vintner, but I think, I mean, there's basically wine grapes grow well between 30 and 50 degrees north and south latitude.
Right.
There's bands. And America fits within that band completely. There are grapes grown and made into wine in every state in America. Every state has wine. However, they're not all fine wines. There are different kinds of grapes. There's Vitis vinifera, which are fine wine grapes, and then there's Vitis lambrusca, I think is what it's called, for the like more table type grapes. So like in here in Pennsylvania, there are wineries near me. There's a lot in like Erie County because it starts to get colder up there. But grapes that grow well, those kind of more, the Lambrusca grapes tend to be sweeter. So they make sweet wines.
I see.
They're perfectly lovely. If you like that, that's great. But they're not considered AVAs, which are like fine wine designations, American viticultural areas, the way that like the Willamette Valley is or different part, the Columbia Valley in Washington or Sonoma or Napa Valley in California, all over California. There's a lot. And one thing that you'll notice about all of those places are they're coastal. It has big water helps grapes.
Oh, I see. Well, it's interesting. I don't want to just be teasing Appalachia all day, but there's also a lot of plum wine and
fruit wines.
Wine.
Yeah, there's a lot of fruit wines here, and that's what I would honestly recommend because the fruit grows well, and then you can make wine. You can make wine out of any fruit juice. It's just that fine wines are known for their balance of acid and tannin and alcohol and sugar. And acid and sugar play well together, but acid is really what makes a fine wine good with food. Like acid is what makes drinks good with food. Oh. And sweet wines, if they're all sugar, they just don't have acid. Acid forms in grapes when the grapes struggle. So either because it's cold or there's not a lot of water, so it's good drainage. So it needs to have water, but not too much water. You don't want grapes to be too sweet and ripened the way table grapes would be. That won't make a good wine because it doesn't have enough acid content. So, yeah, grapes are difficult.
They're little brats, aren't they?
The grapes that make good wine are hard to grow. They're hard to grow.
So I should say two things. One, of course, as most futurelings know, I am I've been sober for 31 years.
Wow. That's incredible. And congratulations.
As part of that, you would assume that I had never really spent, because I was poor and like kind of grotty before I got sober. And so, for instance, I've never had a single malt whiskey.
Oh,
I've
sure.
never had a great number of cocktails. I think I had one old fashioned at one point and was like, this is repulsive. There were so many things in alcohol culture that I never experienced because I didn't have the money or discernment before I got sober.
Yeah.
But my uncle was in wine.
Okay.
And my cousins own a winery in the Willamette Valley.
Oh.
Called the Knutson Winery.
Oh.
They make Pinot Noir and Chardonnay. And they were the ones that started my uncle was a partner in the Argyle Sparkling Wine Company.
Yes.
And that was one of the early, very early Oregon sparkling wines where they were like, we're going to just go the whole hog. We've been to France. And of course, Argyle became a celebrated sparkling wine.
Right.
And so they have an enormous vineyard there in Dundee, Oregon. And as a kid, I was down in Dundee quite a bit and so was exposed to wine at a young age and drank a lot of what would, because my uncle's, he spent a lot of time in France and his right. wine cellar was some thing of great mysteriousness where people would come to visit it.
Oh.
And so I was routinely being given a glass of wine that everybody else was swirling around in the glass and was looking up at the ceiling and like, la, 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 la.
Right.
And, you know, and I was whatever, 15 and like, man, this tastes just as bad as any other glass of wine.
Yeah, that's too bad.
But so I was exposed to quite a bit of wine and did have the experience of trying to learn about it and drink it before I ended up, you know, feeling like I couldn't drink anymore. But I also saw a lot of wine people, you know, fancy wine people mm-hmm. who were also just sots, like drunks.
Oh, yeah.
Where they were because they were wealthy, wine was kind of their excuse to mm-hmm. just be drunk all the time.
Yeah.
And I know a lot of wine people aren't drunks.
I do think there's something to be said about the reality of alcohol as a social lubricant that leads to more alcohol, right? So, and because wine comes in bottles instead of glasses, I do think in my experience, it's not uncommon for people to be drinking wine, having a good time, being like, let's open another bottle. That can certainly lead to more drunkenness than might happen if you were just like, well, let's have another one more beer. But the other thing that's interesting, this is some wine history stuff, is in old world wine, which is European wine, so France, Italy, Spain, Portugal, Austria, historically, the alcohol content is much lower than the style of wine that is preferred in the American market. So, and it used to be that California wines, New World wines, which is California, Australia, New Zealand, South America, Chile, and Argentina as well, and Oregon and Washington too, all these New World places would make wines that were higher in alcohol content bigger because coming off of Prohibition and after the war in the 1950s, wine was competing with the cocktail culture. So in Europe, wine is a grocery. You have a glass of wine as part of a meal to complement the meal. It's like a salad. I mean, not exactly. It's still alcohol, but the flavor of it and the notes of it are intended as part of the meal, as opposed to in America, where alcohol is more consumed alone, like not necessarily always with food. And particularly in kind of the cocktail culture of the middle of the 20th century. So winemakers had to make their wine strong enough so that a glass of wine could compete with a martini. They're still not that strong, but they are stronger. And now European winemakers make wine for American, for export to America that is stronger. So it's very difficult to find a wine in America that's less than 13% alcohol. Usually they're at 14 now.
And it, really?
Which is, I mean, port wine, which is fortified, is like 20%. And it used to be that 15% was above the limit of what you could sell as a non-fortified wine, but now you'll see 15% wine all the time. If you're in Europe getting, you know, if you're getting French wine in France, it's probably 12%. So I think that's part of it too. People think like, well, this is just wine. It's not as strong as a cocktail, so I can have more of it, but it adds up.
It really does.
So I don't mean to make any kind of moral judgments about that, but just to say some facts of why that might be happening. With wine, when people don't realize how strong what they're drinking is.
Right. And explain just the science of wine for a moment, because I would have assumed if you weren't fortifying it, mm-hmm. the alcohol content would be a component of just the age of it. Like the alcohol went up as it aged. But how is alcohol...
That is not correct.
Okay. So how is alcohol... is the alcohol intensity... Mm-hmm. managed in what seems to be a pretty, and this is maybe my mistake, and because I think of cheese this same way, which is throw everything in the barrel and cork it, and then it's up to God,
sure,
to determine what happens.
That's called natural wine.
Okay,
not really, and that's a hilarious joke for like three people. So.
Three people from Pittsburgh are like,
three of my friends are like, oh, Katie, making a joke about natural wine again. Yeah, you can cut that.
Natural wine sounds like a song from the early 1970s. It sounds like something from 10cc. Here's a gross fact.
Stop the podcast.
Stop the podcast.
Hi, everybody. Just to let you know, this episode of Fish is sponsored by TV licensing.
Yes, TV licensing. What are you watching on TV, Andy?
I have been watching a show that's called 2 Weeks in August.
Okay.
Despite it being July at the time of recording.
Oh, you don't have to watch TV shows in the time that their name references.
No, absolutely. I watched The Darling Buds of May in winter. Anyway, 2 Weeks in August. It's a really good series. It's set on a lovely Mediterranean holiday.
Ooh.
And it's a group of old mates from uni who've gathered together. Some of them have got kids. Some of them haven't. Some of them have been going through big life events. And it's one of those amazing pressure cooker series where things just get more and more and more tense.
Oh, those stressful ones.
I love it. I love it.
I love my comedy, I gotta say. So I have been watching Android, which is Diane Morgan's new thing, and I absolutely love it. But I always on television watch everything with someone from Bolton in it. That's basically all I watch.
And she's from Bolton.
She's from Bolton.
But in this show, I believe she's a robot.
She's a robot, and it is not certain where in the country she's from.
It depends where the facility is that makes her, I suppose.
I guess so. But what are we actually here to say?
Oh, we're here to say that if you want to watch any of these shows, your TV license covers you to watch over 400 TV channels and everything on BBC iPlayer.
That is incredible.
So 2 Weeks in August has finished going out now, but you can get hold of it on the iPlayer.
If you want to find out more about this, then go to tvl.co.uk/pod.
Now back to the tension and the stress and the misery of this episode of Fish.
Oh, I thought you were referencing Bolton. On with the podcast.
There's a movement in winemaking called natural wine or biodynamic wine because, so let me back up and just say the way that alcohol is made is that yeast eat sugar and produce alcohol and carbon dioxide. That's fermentation. that's it. So that's how beer starts, which is how liquor, you know, whiskey starts, and that's how wine starts too. So a fruit juice, usually a grape juice, has sugar in it because the juice, as the grapes ripen, they develop sugars and acid in the juice. The winemakers, the wine, you know, the vineyard, the vintners, the wine growers pick the grapes when they're ready and crush them. And historically, like, the reason there's been fermented things as long as there's been humans to pay attention to it is because there are yeast naturally in the air in farms. So like yeast will just, like, they're around, they're microorganisms that are around, and they will eventually start eating that sugar and causing fermentation. That's why if you have apple cider in your refrigerator for too long, it will start to turn. And in biodynamic and natural wines, they depend on those naturally occurring yeasts to do the work. But for most wine production, the wine, the juice, once it's pressed, is inoculated with particular strands of yeast that have been cultivated and cultured, I guess, cultivated for making wine.
Oh, so, it's like a sourdough.
Yeah. Yes.
Do these winemakers carry little bags of their, like, wine starter around?
So I don't think
little leather pouch around their belt.
There's a whole industry of cultivating yeast to sell for winemaking. I'm sure there are winemakers who culture their own. There must be. But there's also a whole industry of just cultivating yeast in labs, I guess, to sell to winemakers to make wine.
And somewhere out there, I'm now suddenly aware of yeast cultivators.
Yep.
In white lab coats, maybe. Or
I,
like,
think,
jean
probably.
Jackets.
Yeah.
Who are, their whole are job the is like, well, these are my yeasts.
Right. We're going to make, like, more of these yeasts.
Yeah. And there's
to,
like,
make the good wine.
Yeast salesmen that fly around the country in brown shoes who are like, you got to buy my yeasts.
Yeah. There must be.
Wow.
There must be.
All right. Well, so moving right along.
So the yeast are purchased from the guy in the brown shoes, and the winemaker puts them into the big tub of juice, and fermentation begins.
That was my nickname in college.
Big tub of juice. So they then fermentation begins, and that fermentation ends a couple of different ways. But winemakers, and again, that I am not a winemaker, it's an incredibly complicated craft, but they know when they want the fermentation to stop. So they're testing how strong the wine is, you know, they're testing the alcohol levels and things like that. Also, wines will be blended. So there might be one tub that gets a little higher in alcohol, another one gets lower, and they blend those together. But yeast eventually will die because they can't live in an environment that has too much alcohol in it. So they're like little suicide machines a little bit. Like they will, if left alone, eat all the sugar until they've made an environment they can't survive in. Other ways that the winemaker can stop fermentation. So they can add things, like they can add chemicals probably of some sort, not unnatural ones, but some, they know some way to put something in this mix and then the yeast will stop. Or if they'll drop the temperature, if it's too cold, the yeast will die. And so basically they can stop the fermentation at the level that they want, and they can style the wine. And there's also different strains of yeast who can survive different levels of alcohol, right? So, but the thing is, if a grape starts with a lot of sugar, then the potential for alcohol is higher because sugar turns into alcohol. So if you have a grape that doesn't have a lot of sugar in it, if it's not very ripe, it can only get so strong because there just isn't sugar in there. Some wines are made by adding additional sugar to boost fermentation. But that wouldn't be done in like a fine wine environment for the most part.
Part of what a vintner is doing is going around looking at the grapes and going, it has enough sugar. We got to get it out of here. We got to pick them now.
Yep. Yeah. They're looking for a certain level of ripeness, which is measured in a metric called Brix, B-R-I-X, which is a metric of residual sugar in a grape.
I know in whiskey, there is some real premium put on a single barrel. Mm-hmm. Because blended whiskeys are the norm.
Right.
And so this idea that the whiskey from this one barrel would be so magical that you wouldn't want to blend it with other things.
Right.
Is that also true of wine, that blended wines are generally how wine is made, but there are certain like vats that are just like...
Yes.
Like well, vat 69, for
yeah,
instance?
Maybe... Maybe at that level in certain like estate wineries, they probably do that. But often it would be more like a year, like a really good year in some wines, or maybe there's a particular field or subsection of an estate that has like the very best wines. And so they make wine with only those grapes. They don't blend them more broadly. It's just like some fancy name, like... I don't know, the right. Roderick acreage, and you have your own particular wine. But it's very, in Champagne, most champagnes are non-vintage because the way champagne is made is starts the same as all other wine. Grapes are grown, picked, crushed, and fermented and made into wine. And then most of the time, those wines are blended with other wines from that maker to get the style of wine that they prefer at that house. And it might not all be from the same year. Oh. So they will have wine that has been waiting to be mixed, because champagne in some ways is similar to beer and like bourbon more than other wines, in that a champagne house has a style of their champagne and they're working to replicate that same style in every new batch, rather than featuring the excellent notes of a particular year of grapes. They're trying to always have a Moët Brut taste pretty much the same. However, if there's a really good year in Champagne, then they'll make a vintage Champagne, or like the, and they don't make them every year. So Dom Pérignon is like the prestige cuvée of Moët and Chandon. So people have heard of Dom Pérignon. They may not know it's made by Moët and Chandon. But they've only made around 50 vintages of Dom Pérignon in the last 75 years. Like, they don't make it every year. So it has to be a really good year. And then they don't mix those grapes with other years to make a non-vintage champagne. They make a vintage champagne and they put the year on it. So if you see a bottle of champagne that has a year on it, that means it's from a particularly good year. And it will always be more expensive than the non-vintage ones because it's more select.
And so with other wines, the aging adds taste to the wine, a certain year. And my understanding is that there's kind of a bell curve, and it starts to, in most cases, after too long, it doesn't matter whether it's a 52, it's just sort of like too old.
Yeah, I think so. There's, when wine is made, it's often aged in a barrel before it's bottled. So red wines especially, but some white wines as well, certainly Chardonnays in California, but then some others, some French Chardonnays as well, will be aged in oak barrels for 3 months, 18 months. In Spain, sometimes they do 3 to 5 years in oak. But that first aging, not in the bottle, but in the barrel, is putting tannin into the wine from the barrel itself. The wood of the barrel itself has tannins that are going into the wine to enrich that. And also, it's like smoothing out the wine. It's allowing the acid and the sugar and the tannins to kind of blend together and become a little smoother over time. And then when it's in the bottle, that continues, that kind of blending and smoothing off the rough edges over time. But not all wines are really even made to age. And it's true that most wines now are made to last for 10 years on your shelf, but most wines are not styled in the way that they're made to last for 50 years. It doesn't, and I think that's a market, that's an impact of the market realities as much as anything else. But it actually does have to do with, like, expert winemakers know when they pull a grape off the vine, like they can, you know, they can, maybe not one grape, but they can pull a section of grapes and be able to select the wines that will make a, select the grapes that will make a wine that can last for 40 years. And they make some of those, but that's just not what the market, like, that wouldn't be smart business to make only those.
Okay, so this is interesting. And you'll say that then, does champagne age in the bottle like a Chardonnay would, or does champagne go into the bottle And it's meant to, at any time that it comes out, have the that quality, that character, the distinctive, like, this is a Moët and Chandon, and I can depend on it to taste this way.
So they will, the winemakers themselves, the champagne houses, will keep the wine in the bottle, in the caves, for a while before they release it. Like, you won't see, even if it were a vintage, you wouldn't see it for a couple of years. Like, batches, they're not, like, done and released. They are held to age for a while before they're released to the market. And then, yes, you can hang on to them for a while. And champagne is different than other wines because of what's called the second fermentation, which is after the wine is made, it's blended to reflect the style of that house. Then it's put into the bottle and inoculated again with more yeast and a little bit of sugar. So there's a second fermentation, and then the bottles are closed so that more alcohol is created when the fermentation happens, but also the carbon dioxide, which is the other thing, is stuck in the bottle. It can't escape. That's when fermentation happens in the big tanks, the carbon dioxide goes into the air. But when it's happening in the bottle, that's where the bubbles come from.
Uh-huh.
And that's the best stuff. That's, Dom Perignon said, come quickly, I'm tasting the stars. That's what we're chasing. And champagne's really interesting because, well, for a lot of reasons, but it wasn't a viable product until they figured out how to make glass bottles strong enough to hold the pressure. Because there can be multiple atmospheres of pressure inside a bottle of sparkling wine. And so you have to have a bottle. I have one here, actually, John, for the YouTube audience, that has a very, this is called a punt in the bottle. It's just like
where the bottom is indented.
Yeah, it comes up. Yeah. Because that gives more strength. And also champagne glass bottles are much heavier and thicker than regular wine because they because of the pressure.
That's why they're so good in a bar fight.
Yes.
Where
always grab a champagne bottle in a bar fight. You will murder someone.
Now, I have to say, you should do that. We all know that you can't just call an Oregon wine like Argyle a champagne because people in a certain part of France are litigious.
Yes.
But sparkling wine is such a much lamer term than champagne, which is like so phenomenal. Why don't winemakers come up with some kind of catchy, like, word for sparkling wine that sounds French? Like, you know, the same way that Chevrolet names cars with words that are just like Camaro. What is that? Sounds pretty rock and roll, but like,
it does. It does feel like a real opportunity.
Mm-hmm.
John, if you or there's some crack marketing person out there, because that's a really good point.
Yeah, I'm not a brander, but I know there are some branders and marketers who are futurelings who might be able to, think up something that's.
And different countries make sparkling wine in the same method, the traditional method, where the wine is second fermented in the bottle. And they have their own names for it. So in Spain, those wines are called cava. In Italy, they're called Franciacorta. In California and the U.S., it's just sparkling wine. And I think part of the reason is because they did used to call it champagne until France sued everybody to stop them doing that. It is unfortunate we don't have another word for that. In California winemaking, when some California winemakers, when they use a Bordeaux blend of grapes, which is a red wine from France, Bordeaux, they can't call it a Bordeaux. They use the word meritage, which looks like heritage, but with an M. And they pronounce it meritage, not meritage. But that's a word that was made up and used to replace because they couldn't say Bordeaux on their
label.
That's
so California.
It's sparkling wines are beautiful and they are all over the world. Anywhere that wine grapes are grown, someone's making a sparkling version of it. But the grapes that you mentioned earlier in Oregon, Pinot Noir and Chardonnay, are the main grapes of Champagne. They're also the grapes grown in Burgundy, which is just south of Champagne and was like their main rival. So Burgundy makes these beautiful still wines, Pinot Noir and Chardonnay based. And then just a little bit north in Champagne, where it's even colder and so even harder to grow grapes, they've grown those same grapes but styled them in the Champagne style, which is beautiful as well. I learned in preparing for this omnibus that, in fact, New Mexico claims to be the first place in the New World where wine was made in the 1640s.
Because of the Spanish.
Because of the Spanish, because they needed, communion wine. They needed sacramental wine for daily mass. And it took a really long time to get it shipped from Spain. So they started growing grapes and making their own wine in New Mexico in the 1640s. Let's talk about land rights.
Oh, the best.
Yeah, everyone loves a good real estate conversation. So the thing about Champagne is that the region in France, that is the Champagne region, has only, I wrote this down because I was like, wow, that's not a lot. 84,000 acres of grapes, of like wine growing vineyards. It's 4% of the wine growing region in France. So France grows wine grapes everywhere, beautiful grapes from wines from all over France. Champagne is really, really small. And because of the laws, which are called the Appellation Origine Contrôlée. I have no French accent. But anyway, the laws in France that say for a wine to be called, to be named after the region that the wine is from, it has to follow certain rules. And they're slightly different for every region, but it's almost always that the grapes had to have been grown there and the wine has to have been made there. So you can't like grow the grapes here and ship them somewhere else to be made, like the growing and vice versa. You can't bring in grapes from outside and make the wine here. The grapes and the making have to happen in this one place. And so Champagne has this worldwide reputation because it's this beautiful product, but it's very limited in how much of it can ever be made because there's just only so many square acres where these grapes can be grown because the region is so small. And so a lot of the time, wine prices, like any good economist knows, is a question of supply and demand. And there are all kinds of constraints on the supply of these grapes. One, it's cold there. Like, it's not really super warm. So they can only grow so many grapes because the climate doesn't support like just multiple harvests of grapes every year. They have a growing season and they grow as many grapes as they can, but that's limited. They're grown in chalky soil on hillsides. Much of Champagne grapes grow really well on hillsides because they need drainage, but that means a lot of the time the grapes are picked by hand. So there's labor costs involved. That becomes more expensive. Then the method of making these wines is also very labor intensive and takes a lot of time. So there's all these constraints that make the supply smaller and smaller, which means the price goes up and up.
How often is there something like a hailstorm or yeah, a plague of locusts and everything in this tiny region is affected and it all, and there's a year where it just all goes to hell?
Yep, that can definitely happen. And really, in the last 10 years, the changing climate situation has really been affecting the winemaking in Europe because, as we've talked about now a couple of times, grapes need to struggle. If it gets too warm, they don't get the acid they need to make good wine. So the grapes will grow on the vine, but they're not the right makeup to make the kind of wine that winemakers are trying to make. And so it is impacting everything. And in fact, here in North America, there's a small wine region in Niagara, Niagara on the Lake near Niagara Falls. It's in Canada, and they make beautiful ice wines. They're one of the only places in the world that still makes ice wine. This is a divergence, but ice wine, one of the rules to be called an ice wine is the grapes have to be picked while they're frozen and pressed while they're frozen. So what? There's this like, yeah. So it's, and there's like these stories of like, it's Christmas Eve and the grapes freeze and everyone goes out to the fields to pick the grapes because you have to do it. There's all these limits to it. And when you crush a frozen grape, the juice, the sugars in the juice are far more concentrated. And so they make these beautiful, really sweet wines. Germany also has a long history of ice wine. That's where it comes from originally. But ice wines are not being made because it's not getting cold enough for the grapes to freeze. And so even in Niagara, they have to decide, are we going to leave grapes on the vine in hopes that they will freeze and we can make an ice wine vintage? Or are we going to pick these grapes early and just make some sweet wines because it's a gamble? It might not get cold enough.
Wow.
So it's a really interesting, there are a lot of climate implications to winemaking.
Does that suggest that maybe 100 years from now, we're all going to be drinking Swedish and Norwegian wine?
Yes. Wow. I mean, maybe. Wow. I do think that it's possible that the wine regions will need to go north, but that's the thing. The rivers aren't north because it isn't just the weather. It's also the diurnal nature of hills alongside rivers and lakes, and they don't necessarily have... They can't replicate all those things
right.
just because
Dutch
it gets cold.
Wine is not going to be the same.
Right. I mean, so
swamp
it's, yeah.
wine, they call it.
Stop the podcast.
Stop the podcast.
Hi, everybody. Just to let you know, this episode of Fish is sponsored by TV licensing.
Yes, TV licensing. What are you watching on TV, Andy?
I have been watching a show that's called 2 Weeks in August.
Okay.
Despite it being July at the time of recording.
Oh, you don't have to watch TV shows in the time that their name references.
No, absolutely. I watched The Darling Buds of May in winter. Anyway, 2 Weeks in August. It's a really good series. It's set on a lovely Mediterranean holiday.
Ooh.
And it's a group of old mates from uni who've gathered together. Some of them have got kids. Some of them haven't. Some of them have been going through big life events. And it's one of those amazing pressure cooker series where things just get more and more and more tense.
Oh, those stressful ones.
I love it. I love it.
I love my comedy, I gotta say. So I've been watching Android, which is Diane Morgan's new thing, and I absolutely love it. But I just, for me, I always, on television, watch everything with someone from Bolton in it. That's basically all I watch.
And she's from Bolton.
She's from Bolton.
But in this show, I believe she's a robot.
She's a robot, and it is not certain where in the country she's from.
It depends where the facility is that makes her, I suppose.
I guess so. But what are we actually here to say?
Oh, we're here to say that if you want to watch any of these shows, your TV license covers you to watch over 400 TV channels and everything on BBC iPlayer.
That is incredible.
So 2 Weeks in August has finished going out now, but you can get hold of it on the iPlayer.
If you want to find out more about this, then go to tvl.co.uk/pod.
Now back to the tension and the stress and the misery of this episode of Fish.
Oh, I thought you were referencing Bolton. On with the podcast.
Wine's in trouble. That's the story. Wine's in trouble. Also, people don't drink as much. And anyway, but it's so beautiful and worth trying if you haven't yet. And you are a person who drinks alcohol. I recommend getting your hands on some champagne. But know that if it is champagne from France, it's going to be expensive. Like right. You cannot get a bottle of good champagne for now, I think less than $60
Whoa,
a few years ago.
Whoa, no
50.
Kidding.
Yeah. But the good news is that the method and the learning of how to make these beautiful wines from France, from the main houses, these businesses, right? These people are in business. They're like, how do we expand? We can't like go next door outside of Champagne and make this and call it Champagne. So what are we going to do? Oh, let's buy some land in America. So many of the major French champagne houses have California subsidiaries that make sparkling wine in the same method with the same kinds of grapes as they do in Champagne, but under American names. So right. Moët and Chandon in France has the Domaine Chandon in California. Mumm in France has Mumm Napa in California. So there's several. There's more. Carneros, and there's lots of them. And so they're using the same method, but they're growing grapes in Napa or Sonoma to do that, which is not the same climate or soil as in Champagne.
Right.
But that's still, they're still great wines, and they cost $20 to $25 a bottle instead of $60. But the family I want to tell you about today is the Gruet family, who started making champagne in 1952 in a small little co-op house. And then in the 80s, learned that, they were exploring to find places they could expand because you can't afford more real estate in Champagne. Like, I'm sure there's none available. Like,
they were a French family,
the Gruet family. Yes. Gilbert, I think is how you pronounce Gruet.
Well done.
He started making champagne in the 50s in France. And then in the 80s, he traveled to New Mexico because he knew of some people, another French family that he knew that were growing grapes outside of Truth or Consequences in New Mexico. And so they came and found that the hills of, and they ended up in Engel, New Mexico, that the hills there were similar in kind of the kind of soil that they were looking for and the climate they were looking for, similar to what they had in Champagne. And so they started as an experiment growing Pinot Noir and Chardonnay there in the 80s. And they released their first Champagne in 1989 to great. It's been just was very, very well received. And they've been making wine, sparkling wines there ever since. They're now part of a larger conglomerate that's based in Seattle, actually. So there are some Gruet label wines that are from Washington as well, but they're ones from New Mexico were very well received. In 2011, their Blanc de Noir was number 43 in the top 100 list of wines in Wine Spectator. And I'm a big fan of their wines. I have a bottle with me in case I needed a visual aid at any point, but I paid $20 for it, and it's beautiful wine. So there's a lot of options, and when you take some of those constraints away, then economically you can afford to make more wine and sell it for less money.
Now, when you're talking about truth or consequences, that yes. region is not what I would have expected, because that is not up in the mountains of northern New Mexico.
Right.
That is down by the White Sands Missile Range, like Albuquerque, what I would yeah. call just desert nowhere.
Yeah, though. It's south of Albuquerque. And here's why I think. So Champagne grapes in Champagne, the soil in Champagne is chalky. Mm-hmm. That's like what made Champagne work for the kinds of wines that they make, is it's a very chalky soil, which in the case of Champagne also means there's all of these multi-thousand-year-old caves underground that stay at the same temperature all year, so they can like age their wine in the caves. Mm. These naturally occurring caves that have made a huge difference in the making of Champagne and also in the history of the region. But what happens is those are soils that get warm during the day and they hold the warmth so that the grape roots don't get too cold at night. And so I think that maybe that white sand soil of New Mexico has a similar feature. I am very surprised by this every time I read about it, and I have not yet been to see it, so I don't know exactly. But there's some hills, but it's not like the Rocky right. foothills. Yeah.
Right. And I guess the desert gets cold at night, but it gets yeah. warm
but
as
it gets warm.
Hell during yeah. the day.
Well, there's altitude that helps with that.
Yeah, I see.
I guess.
But I mean, you're not far from like Juarez. Like you're
right?
You're not far from Mexico in that part of New Mexico. So I'm astonished to find this out.
Well, me too. And like I said, I haven't been there, so I don't know. But I always, when I used to work at the wine shop I mentioned earlier, it was always fun for me to sell Gruet wine and be able to say, like, guess where this sparkling wine came from? And it's so good. Who would have thought? It's beautiful. You can get things from anywhere. I mean, Champagne is a really interesting place historically as well. So I always recommend that people go and visit there if they're in France. It's like an hour and a half train ride from Paris to get to Reims, and it's beautiful. There's a smaller version of the Notre Dame Cathedral there that is where the kings of France were coronated for 1,000 years or so. Not, is that right? 1,000? Yeah, like 1,000 years. They started in 1898 was the first time. Or one of the first times, I guess. I just did a little research.
Started in 1898.
No, 898. Yeah. And then I think, you know, till the last couple there, about give or take 900 years or so.
Right. And when you think about Champagne as a region, right, you would think of it as kind of a blob, but it's really like a corridor almost, right? It's like long and tall.
Yeah. I mean, it's pretty small. It's a little bit of compared to the other wine regions in France, I think Champagne is very compact.
Yeah.
Like the Loire is very wide and Burgundy is very long and Bordeaux is very wide. But yeah, Champagne is kind of small.
So did
this map?
Oh yeah, look at that. Well, that looks like the kind of map that you would give to a World War II aviator to navigate France after he crashed.
Yeah, it's a tea towel for sure. It's a tea towel, but you could see Champagne's up here.
Yeah. Well, yeah. So now did this family relocate? I don't know why I pronounced it that way, but relocate to millionaire relocate yes. to New Mexico, and now they're no longer living in France, and their children are
The father, the patriarch of the family, Gilbert, I believe, stayed in France and continued to run their Champagne business there, and his two children, his son and his daughter, came to run the American version, and they're still doing so, I believe.
Is that a major business?
Yeah. I mean, it's interesting because I'm not sure what their total, I think I read, I didn't do a good enough job on this, 300,000 okay. bottles or cases. I bet cases annually. Like their wine is available in 49 states. So that means that they're producing at a volume to distribute. Most of the time, if you do any kind of wine touring, like if you were to go to Napa to see all the wineries, a lot of those wineries, you can only get their wine if you're in a club because they don't make enough to distribute. So the fact that Gruet distributes so widely, it's a major undertaking now. Yeah. Most of the wine that's available to the public in like a standard liquor store, wine store, grocery store is owned by probably one of five major conglomerates of wine. And they're making anything that's making enough volume to be distributed is now controlled by Constellation or one of the other big ones. So those small wineries, I do think they are more, very much more like a small business. And certainly the tourism part of it is part of that. You know, I don't know the proportion of how many wineries in Sonoma and Napa County are actually making enough wine to be distributing versus just their wine club where they ship wine. But I think, I mean, there's an old chestnut about, you know, how do you make $1 million in wine? Well, first you spend $2 million.
Right. Like
spend, it's not, yeah, it's a pretty tough. Yeah. Yeah. It's a pretty tough, business. And it is agriculture. Like, don't forget, this is an organic product. So those fires in Napa over the last few years have destroyed entire years of crops, and it takes time to recover, and anything weird happens, that's it. It's not like you can just get backup juice to make wine at scale. I mean, you can get juice and make wine at your house, but you can't do that at scale. So, I mean, one of the things that's interesting about wine is how sometimes the people who make the wine also grew the grapes, but oftentimes they didn't. Oftentimes those are different. Like sometimes the farmer who's growing the grapes is also the vintner who's making the wine, but oftentimes winemakers are what are called negociants who buy grapes from lots of different makers to put them together to make the style of wine that they want. In California, when you go to like small places where you're visiting, oftentimes they're growing their estate wines where they're growing the grapes and making the wine there. I think that would be a very difficult business to get into because you have to be a farmer and a winemaker. I think for people who are like, I want to spend my life learning about and making wine, you can go to UC Davis and learn how to do that and go get a job at someone else's winery and, you know, kind of work in the system, because wine has, there's artisanal and then there's industrial and there's a whole lot of space in between. So I suspect if you want to do artisanal wine, that's a risky business endeavor. If you just want to work in wine, there's lots of ways to do that.
Yeah, traveling around the Willamette Valley and around Dundee, you know, rolling hills, and it's just beautiful country. And there are these whole tours where you just go from one little vintage to the next, and they all have little tasting rooms, and they're farming right there, and they're making the wine right there. It's a great, I mean, I don't drink, right? So I'm just going to these things for the cheese.
Right.
And not even the goods.
Right.
Because how many t-shirts do I need from different Oregon wineries? But it's really and I think you could drive by the Willamette Valley on the road and not even really be aware of this whole ecosystem, not just of like an environmental ecosystem, but a cultural and economic ecosystem.
Right.
But you're saying that wine drinking, wine consumption on the whole is in decline?
Yes. And I think that is a boomer thing.
Again.
Again. Oh,
boomers.
Man. Boomers. But truly, just at the wine shop I used to work at, when I started working there 20 years ago, there were lots of people in their 50s who would come in and buy a case of wine every week or every month, and they socialized and they entertained, and now they're in their 70s or, you know, even older, and they're not supposed to drink. It's not good for you. And they're right. drinking a lot less. But they're like Gen X didn't come up behind them and, you know, to buy. That's probably Gen X's fault again.
Yeah, it's once again. It's because we're slackers and we just slacked our responsibility.
Well, and like didn't get into it. And I think the cachet of wine as this like hoity-toity thing doesn't do it any favors, especially mm-hmm. like with younger people who now are Marxists. Just drinking. Yeah, if they're drinking, they're drinking White Claw. And lots of people are not, lots of young people don't drink at all. And like the rise of the craft brewing scene, I think maybe scratched a similar itch to like knowing about the way that knowing about wine used to be something that people would do as a hobby. Like, oh, I'm like really into craft brewing and that's far more local. So, I mean, there's tons of microbreweries in Pittsburgh, you know, like there's a way that wine doesn't necessarily connect to community in the same way some other things do. So I guess it depends what you're looking, what you want alcohol, like what function you want alcohol to serve. And then does wine fit the bill best for people? And unfortunately, as of someone who loves wine, I'm sad that it's not as popular, but I don't buy a case of wine a week. Nice. And I'm social. Thank goodness. Yeah.
Well, yeah. Well, but yeah, and it is strange, especially given that food culture mm-hmm. seems always on the rise. And there are a lot of people that identify as foodies and mm-hmm. want to talk about food in these terms. And you're absolutely right about craft brewing. You know, there's that certain kind of person with a curly Q mustache who has a leather apron.
Right.
Who it can talk to you all day about beer.
Right.
And those leather apron curlicue people probably used to be in winemaking.
Right. And that's the thing. Like you can make beer, you can get grain anywhere. You know, it's a lot harder to source good grapes and you can't, and wine are, I don't know if wine works at the scale that like a microbrewery can start at. Like I think the barrier to entry for starting wine is very high. And so you're not going to have the same kind of hobbyist culture around it. I will say one of the things that's happening in like kind of the alcohol business right now is the rise of NA options, right? All of these non-alcoholic options. And I certainly have not tried all of them, but I would just say non-alcoholic wine is really tough because they filter. They just use filters to get the alcohol molecules out. But that's also like the alcohol is where the structure comes from. And a lot of the flavor is in bigger molecules than the alcohol. So they just strip.
Right.
It's not, I hope that there's a futureling listening who's like, actually, I know this great NA winemaker and they figured it out and you should try it and I will. But I would just say the ones I've had, it's pretty disappointing. So yeah, better off to just have something else altogether.
It feels like just get some Welch's grape juice or Martinelli's. We drink Martinelli's every Christmas.
Yeah.
It's delicious non-alcoholic
sparkling. Yeah.
Sparkling wine. Get
sparkling juice. Don't try to get an NA sparkling. That's my recommendation.
Well, Katie, this has been a great episode. I've really enjoyed it. But I have to say that there's been very little Nazi content and almost every other omnibus. And I think this has been part of the problem of Omnibus 2.0. Ken and I made sure to always find a way to bring World War II into it, really random topics. And this is taking place in, so a lot of this episode is taking place in France.
Yeah.
Tell me that there is a World War II component to your story.
John, I would never have dared to come to talk to you on the Omnibus Project without bringing some very high quality Nazi content for you and World War II. So, it's very important. It's a huge part of the Champenois history. Reims, as the center of the Champagne region, was occupied starting in 1940. So for 5 years, it was occupied during the war. And even though Hitler himself did not drink, his lieutenants were big drinkers and loved champagne. And so all over France, there were these men called Weinführers, Weinführers, wine leaders, who were assigned to the various wine regions to basically pillage the wine from the French people to pillage their their wares.
This feels like a Hermann Göring like enterprise.
Yes. I've seen his name connected to it for sure. A man named Otto Klebisch was the Weinführer for Champagne. And he requisitioned 400,000 bottles a week of champagne, which was like not possible, right. Eventually not possible, as there was a lot of pressure on the Champenois to continue making wine, but all the wine they were making was going to the Germans. But there was a lot of resistance among the Champenois. And so they did all kinds of things. They would mislabel wine intentionally, send swill with like vintage champagne labels to the Germans, and they got in trouble for that. They would hide their good wine and mislabel it in all these caves because they have miles and miles and miles of chalk caves underground. So wine was hidden. Also, people were hidden there, some. And they also shared intelligence with the Allies. So when a big order of champagne would come in, they would tell the Allies, like, hey, they just ordered a bunch of wine to Northern Africa. I think they're heading there. Wow. So they gave like this. And in fact, there was a man named Count Robert Jean de Vogue, who was the head of the Moët and Chandon Champagne House, which still exists today. And he was eventually sent to a concentration camp. He was arrested because of his resistance and his leadership among the Champenois against the occupation. And he was eventually liberated. He did not die in the concentration camp, but he was supposed to have. He was sentenced to death, but he was liberated in 1945. And in May of 1945, Reims, in the center of Champagne, is where General Eisenhower's office was, where the surrender was signed first. And then the next day, it happened again in Berlin. But the initial surrender happened in Reims. And then all of a sudden, there was real champagne available, pulled out of caves and popped. And all of the Allied forces who liberated Reims were sent home with bottles. And there's a lot of pride still in Champagne for that effort. So it's a beautiful act of resistance and then celebration at the end of the war.
Yeah, you can see where winemakers would be in some ways pretty nonconformist, even though there's a lot of conformity in terms of whatever the rules are, but they're all half in the bag. Of course, they're going to be the ones that are running the resistance.
Well, they were very proud of what they did, and their whole livelihood, their whole community, their history was all under siege. So they fought in all kinds of ways against that during those 5 years. I can't imagine. I mean, I guess I can, but yeah, just incredible. Well,
one other question I have seen over the years, champagne, more than other kinds of wine, like show up in differently sized bottles, including some that are enormous, like ridiculous, ludicrously yes. large bottles of champagne, where That's that true. Isn't true of like Pinot Noir. And right. what's going on with those giant bottles?
So the reason for the giant bottle is it allows better bubble development in the larger vessel. So in that second fermentation, when the bottle is capped and the little yeast are doing their thing and making fermentation and getting all those bubbles, which get integrated in a 750 milligram bottle, there's only so much space. Like eventually they can't do that anymore, but you put them in bigger bottles and then you can have more smooth bubbles, which is like the dream of champagne, is like a really creamy bubble finish. And so actually larger bottles enable that. So like a magnum of champagne, which is two bottles, is a great option if you're going to have a party with champagne. Buy the larger bottle. It's a little bit of a hassle to pour, but the wine itself will actually have a different texture, which is very interesting. So the Champenois took that to extremes, and they have these really large bottles. So like when a ship is christened, they'll have a giant champagne bottle on rope that they send over. And that probably most times is a Melchizedek, which is the equivalent of 40 bottles of champagne. So one bottle is just a bottle, two bottles is a magnum. And after that, four, six, eight, all the way up to 40 bottles equivalent in one bottle. And all those wine bottle sizes are named after biblical kings, which is just a fun thing. And I don't know why that is. It's just one of those, like, oh, this is a fun way. Here's a category of things we could use to name these bottles.
So can you name all the sizes of bottles?
Oh my gosh. I can. Yes, I can.
Okay, good. Yes, I can.
Yes, I can. So one bottle is a Champenois. Two is a Magnum. Four is a Jeroboam. Six is a Rehoboam. Mm-hmm. Eight is a Methuselah.
Yes.
12 is a Salmanazar.
Okay. My favorite of all the biblical kings.
Is it? Is he? He's a good one. 16 is Balthazar. 20 is Nebuchadnezzar. 24 is Solomon.
Okay.
35 is a sovereign. 36 is a primat. Now, those two, I don't think are biblical names. They're
not
just
kings.
Words.
No, they're just describing the bigness.
And then 40 is the Melchizedek, who also maybe wasn't a biblical king, just an old guy. No, that's Methuselah.
Methuselah is an old guy.
Yeah, I guess Melchizedek maybe was a king.
Melchizedek. Boy, my Old Testament knowledge ended right there at Nebuchadnezzar.
Nebuchadnezzar. Yeah, mine too. But anyway, that's a fun thing. There's so many fun things about champagne. It's just a delight. And drinking, it's the best. But just talking about it, it's been really fun too.
And that concludes the Champagne of New Mexico, entry 205.DA0201. Certificate number 31308 in the omnibus. Futurelings, as you well know, I don't have to tell you, Katie and I don't have to remind you that social media is a terrible place unless you are either on champagne-focused social media sites, which, wait a minute, the more I think about it, those have got to be also terrible, terrible places.
Horrible.
So I can only recommend that you go to social media exclusively to communicate with and socialize with other futurelings who at least 20% of you are going to be from Pittsburgh.
Yes.
and probably 10% of you went to Carnegie Mellon and are just constantly agitated. But you can find Futurelings on Facebook, on Reddit, on Discord, just put Futurelings in there. But you can also hang out with us. Also, you can find our posts at Omnibus Project and on all those places. And we're actually trying to get our original Instagram account back, which has been held captive, as far as I know, by iHeartMedia this whole time. I forgot it existed. I think Ken might have forgotten it existed. And then I realized, wait a minute, we have an Instagram account that hasn't been updated since 2021. But you can email us at theomnibusproject@gmail.com and we will answer your email. And if it's really good or if you're really grouchy, we'll answer it on our addenda show.
Oh, okay.
You can go to omnibusproject.com where we are posting episodes and other material, and you can submit a proposal to our show, as Katie did, at omnibusproject.com/submit. You can watch this show on television at youtube.com/@theomnibusproject. And you can mail us actual physical mail to the Omnibus Project, or care of the Omnibus Project, at 609 Southwest 150th Street, number 48084, Burien, Washington, 98166-9998. And Burien, is spelled B-U-R-I-E-N, Burien, Washington. And finally, our show is listener supported. Please consider going to patreon.com/omnibusproject. I think you will find there, even at the lowest level of contribution, that there's a whole separate, probably half an hour, that Katie and I talk and get to know one another.
Yeah.
And she expresses some Carnegie Mellon oriented grievances. But also we learn about the history of Pittsburgh and the Ohio River Valley. So if you subscribe to Patreon, there is this additional bonus content, which is the period that we get to spend with one another, where we get to know each other before we start talking.
Worth every Patreon dollar, I'm sure. We'll do our best.
That's right. Patreon.com/omnibusproject.
Futurelings, from our vantage point in your distant past, we have no idea how long your civilization has survived. We hope and pray that the catastrophe we fear may never come. But if the worst comes soon, this recording, like all of our recordings, may have been our final word. If Providence allows, we wish you many goods and cheese, and we'll be back with you soon for another entry on the Omnibus.
Stop the podcast!
Stop the podcast!
Hi, everybody. Just to let you know, this episode of Fish is sponsored by TV licensing.
Yes, TV licensing. What are you watching on TV, Andy?
I have been watching a show that's called 2 Weeks in August.
Okay.
Despite it being July at the time of recording.
Oh, you don't have to watch TV shows in the time that their name references.
No, absolutely. I watched The Darling Buds of May in winter. Anyway, 2 Weeks in August. It's a really good series. It's set on a lovely Mediterranean holiday.
Ooh.
And it's a group of old mates from uni who've gathered together. Some of them have got kids. Some of them haven't. Some of them have been going through big life events. And it's one of those amazing pressure cooker series where things just get more and more and more tense.
Oh, those stressful ones.
I love it. I love it.
I love my comedy, I gotta say. So I've been watching Android, which is Diane Morgan's new thing, and I absolutely love it. But I just, for me, I always, on television, watch everything with someone from Bolton in it. That's basically all I watch.
And she's from Bolton.
She's from Bolton.
But in this show, I believe she's a robot.
She's a robot, and it is not certain where in the country she's from.
It depends where the facility is that makes her, I suppose.
I guess so. But what are we actually here to say?
Oh, we're here to say that if you want to watch any of these shows, your TV license covers you to watch over 400 TV channels and everything on BBC iPlayer.
That is incredible.
So 2 Weeks in August has finished going out now, but you can get hold of it on the iPlayer.
If you want to find out more about this, then go to tvl.co.uk/pod.
Now back to the tension and the stress and the misery of this episode of Fish.
Oh, I thought you were referencing Bolton. On with the podcast.